You're listening to episode 23 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with Monty Cook. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Johan.
This is John.
And apparently we're running amateur hour around here. This is our second take of the interview because I forgot to record the start of the previous one. So joining
us... We had a three-hour conversation with Monty Cook.
And now it's just gold.
It's gone and he hung up on us and now we just have to cry.
So joining us today is, in fact, Monty Cook. Chad, do you want to re-ask your witty question or...
Oh, who would name their kid Monty?
Teehee, it was funny last time.
Nah, not really that much fun.
Sorry for those of you that weren't here. Yeah,
let's just jump to the important thing. Who are you?
I am a tabletop RPG designer. I've been doing that long enough that I didn't used to have to qualify that when I said tabletop RPG. I could just say RPG. But that was back in the days when...
Everyone presumed it was rocket-propelled grenade, and they're like, damn, that's cool.
Or ridiculously photogenic guy.
Right. That's more modern.
That's the new one. Well,
that's what it was, actually, was ridiculously photogenic. No, so I've been doing this for 24 years.
And you told us before you're 44, so you started when you were 20.
That's right. I started when I was in college. My first published book came out in my third year of college.
What was your first published book, and how did you get that? How did you go from you're sitting in a dorm to you have an RPG book out there?
Well, so the first book was a book for Rollmaster from Iron Crown Enterprises, and it was called Creatures and Treasures 2.
Totally not synonymous with Dungeons and Dragons or anything like that.
Right. Well, you know, for those of you that don't remember Rollmaster, it was basically a more complicated knockoff of D&D, which is really unfair of me to say because it's a game that I really loved at the time and have a lot of affection for still to this day. Back in those days, that's kind of what almost every role-playing game was some version of a knockoff of D&D. That's really not true anymore, of course, but back then it was D&D but with spaceships or D&D but with Cthulhu.
Spelljammer, Ravenloft.
In the case of Rollmaster, it was D&D, but with 50% more tables.
or more, yeah.
Or more.
Yeah, some people called it Chartmaster. So I started with that game. That was the game that I was really into at the time, and a friend of mine had gone to a game convention and had met some people from Iron Crown, found out that they were looking for writers, and I guess thought that I could probably pull that off and put me in touch with them. You know, it was one of those things where... I don't know really what the secret magic thing was that happened. Basically, I wrote them a letter and said, hey, I hear you're looking for writers. I could do that. And they said, okay, do that. And
there was a company that was hurting for people that wanted to write their own RPG.
What they were hurting for was not people who wanted to write their own RPG, but people who wanted to write for their RPG. You know, that's actually the big secret of the game industry, or rather getting into the game industry. And that is that everybody and their brother wants to publish their own role-playing game, but no existing publisher is really looking for anyone to write their own role-playing game. They want you to help support the role-playing game they've already got out there. And so, you know, if you're willing to do that, you're two steps ahead of everybody else.
I guess that makes sense. It kind of mirrors my own background. Obviously, I did not make it that deep into writing RPGs, but I actually got my start as well writing for BattleTech, for an established setting. I never tried pitching my own RPG, though, to FASA, so I don't know how they would have responded, but all right.
I tried pitching my own RPG to a publisher once. It didn't fly.
It's like deciding that you want to go to work for some huge multinational corporation, and you want to start by being a vice president or the president. Super hard, yeah.
Well, they've got D20 and OGL, or whatever OGL has mutated into under Pathfinder's banner now, so you can sort of do your own D&D now. I guess that's
you
kind
can.
Of like that.
Yeah, well, you know, self-publishing that has happened, particularly in the internet in the last 10 years, has changed all of those rules, basically.
So how'd you make the jump from Rollmaster to everything that happened from there? Where'd you end up after that?
After I got out of school, I worked for Iron Crown full-time for a couple of years on Rollmaster and Champions, because at the time they were doing both of those games. And Champions was still is a superhero RPG. Then from there, I became a freelance writer for a while and started doing a lot of work for TSR. And basically, after a whole bunch of stuff that I wrote got canceled because it was all for the Marvel Superheroes game, basically I worked on about a year and a half on different Marvel Superhero products that never came out because right then and there, the company canceled the Marvel license, or rather Marvel canceled the license with TSR.
What do you do with stuff like that? Like, you wrote a whole bunch of stuff, you were like supplements, rules, and fluff, and all this content for this game that got completely canceled, never going to be published.
You run it for your home group and cry.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, do you do that? I mean,
you drink yourself into a stupor, you cry. You know,
do you ever dust it off and like run it for your friends or anything like that? Or do you just like lock it away in shame?
So one of the weird things is that back then when you wrote for TSR, in the really early days of self-publishing, so they were using this antiquated system where you had to put in all these formatting codes. You couldn't just turn over a Word document with things bolded and italics and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So part of being a good freelancer was going through and turning over your manuscript, which of course was filled with jargon and game stats and stuff, and then put in all the formatting codes that went along with that. So actually the manuscripts that I would turn over, until you figured out what you were looking at, just look like gobbledygook. Huh. So it's not even really that fun to like go back and look at it.
So not only did they not take it and publish it, you are left with a product that is practically useless at your own gaming table.
Pretty much.
Kind of stinks.
Yeah, pretty much.
But it's okay. You can just convert the whole thing to Gamma World and it'll be fine. What did you do after Marvel?
Oh. Well, here was the thing, right? I'd been working for them for a year and a half and they liked my work, even though the rest of the world had no idea that I had been doing all this work. And so it was kind of a terrible situation to work as a freelancer for a year and a half and not have anything to show for it, not have a name. You know, I got paid for it, but I didn't have the name, you know, I didn't have the cred out there, right?
Right.
So I was in a kind of a bad situation in that regard. But at that time, Tim Brown, who was the head of the RPG department at that point at TSR, gave me a call and invited me to come work there full time. And the funny thing was at the time when I got that call, I actually didn't want to go to work for TSR, but I wanted to see TSR because I'd been a D&D fan way big time back in the day. So
you didn't want the job. You just wanted the tour of the office and see
what
you
That is exactly right. Yeah, I wanted to just go see where D&D was made, right? Where Gary Gygax's office was, that kind of thing. And the reason that I didn't want to go to work for TSR was because at that time, and we're talking about end of 1993, there were all these rumors that were going through the rest of the game industry that TSR was just sort of the role-playing game equivalent of a sweatshop. And, you know, all of these horrible, beleaguered creative people were stuck in this room and like working on typewriters or something. And of course, I went there and found out that that wasn't true at all, that the people there were great and having fun, and it actually seemed like a really cool place to work. So I, of course, ended up taking the job. And I started there early in 94 and stayed until the company was bought out in 97 by Wizards.
Were you there for the bloat of game systems at the end, or campaign settings, rather? I mean, how did that look like on the ground when you had 15 or 16 or however many different universes running in tandem? Were you guys all just writing your heads off?
Well, there's actually a TSR manager who can be quoted as basically saying, if we can sell 20,000 copies of one product, we can sell 20,000 copies of 15 products. So instead of doing one product a month, let's do 15, right?
So Lee Iacocca, he was not.
So yeah, there was an incredible glut of stuff. But okay, so here's actually the secret cool thing about that, though. Mm-hmm. And that is that at the time, TSR management, the suits, quote unquote, could only pay attention to so many products at once. So if the Eye of Sauron fell on your product, you know, and they were going to fall, they were going to pay attention to you. But that meant everyone else could go off and do interesting, cool, you know, creative stuff.
So, I mean, you didn't necessarily want the suits looking at you.
No, I don't think you did.
From a creative standpoint, no, but from like a budgetary marketing standpoint.
Well, maybe they needed to be. All right, let's take this down to one simple question. Yeah. Red Steel. Under the suits or away from the suits?
Oh, that was away from everybody. I don't think anyone...
We don't even know who wrote that.
Yeah, I have no explanations for Red Steel.
So, but I mean, you had mentioned like Planescape, which is a very popular setting amongst its fans. I've never actually played it, but I've yet to meet a person who hates it.
Yeah. How long has our PvP Planescape game been going on forums? Forever. Like 5 years?
And the Planescape Torment video game is like insanely popular amongst all the grognards who played it. So that was one that, you know, didn't really get the corporate eye. Was it just one person got to like work on something like that and really got to shine and got to be cool? Or was it a team of people are like, hey, nobody's looking, let's just go crazy?
Well, it wasn't always quite so overt as that. I think everyone was trying to do something interesting and original. It was just that the people who didn't have the Eye of Sauron on them actually got to be creative.
So they were like auditing Faerun. And when you had the suits in your room, you had to have Frodo, Sam, Legolas, and Gimli. But when they weren't there, you got to have hamster-powered spacecraft. That sounds like a fun place to work for me.
Well, you know, it was really sort of more like, if you were working on Planescape and they weren't paying attention, you got to do all this creative stuff with interesting narrative voice and really expand out what a D&D adventure could even be. And if the Eye of Sauron was on your product, then you spent 3 weeks in meetings determining which color shade of yellow was on the box.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
You know, the listening to your biography, I'm starting to understand something. You take somebody who worked for the company that was doing Hero System, you take them over to D&D, you end up with Tolis. Think about it. You want a bullet-stopping book in a D&D setting.
Yeah, well, I suppose there's something to that.
Has anyone ever tested the bullet-stopping potential of Tolis?
No, but, you know, they did stopping potential of the Champions, what was it, 4th edition?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And Tolis is considerably thicker, so, you know, there you go.
Ooh, I see a YouTube video in the making here.
I did, however, test one time just the binding strength of Tolis by hurling it across the room as hard as I could. And
okay, what's the story?
Boom.
What's leading up to this?
No, it was purely a test, right? Uh-huh. I wanted to make sure that this book was really sturdy, because, you know, the game industry is actually filled with stories of books that fall apart 20 minutes after you buy them. And
okay,
you
know. So what whiskey were you really drinking? What XY did you really get a letter from?
So I hurled this thing across the room, and I didn't actually even realize how hard I was doing it. And it did not damage, except for one little bent corner, it didn't really damage the book at all.
With the foundation of your house.
It, however, put a really serious dent in the wall, however.
Oh, where did you throw it? Did you just throw it at like the TSR offices or at your own home?
Oh, this was at my house, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, man. Oh well.
If you're going to be reckless, at least do it at work.
Yeah, I know how to patch drywall, so there's...
Well, that's good.
It's right, yeah. It's your excuse for not writing that day. You know, yeah. I was busy patching a hole in the wall from where I'd thrown my own book at the wall. Do you need like a stud finder for Christmas? Because if you could... All right, so obviously your story does not end there, because it's, you know, fairly well known you came back around to the D&D thing at some point here. So where did you end up after the TSR WotC shuffle?
Well, so I went to Wizards of the Coast in Seattle, made the move out there. Almost immediately after, I started working on 3rd edition D&D, and that was just short of 3 years of my life there, which was awesome, right? Three of the best years of my career, working on that with Jonathan Tweet and Skip Williams, and for a part of it, Rich Baker. And so that came out in 2000, and I left the company in 2001, and shortly thereafter started my own design studio, Malhavik Press, where we did all D20 stuff. So that's where we actually produced Tolis and a lot of other pretty successful products. And from there, I basically worked full-time with Malhavik until about 2006, 2007. Then I sort of put Malhavik on the back burner, did a lot of fiction work, wrote a nonfiction book, did some freelance for other companies. Then it was about the middle of last year.
Wait, go ahead. What was the nonfiction book you wrote?
What? Yes.
Is that the conspiracy?
It was, yeah, yeah. The Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracies.
Also, your cookies are done, by the way.
Yeah, I'll turn that off. So, the Skeptics at the Conspiracies, which has nothing to do with the game industry, except for the fact that the publisher came to me to write that book because he knew that I had written a lot about conspiracy theories for games. I wrote a game called Dark Matter with Wolfgang Bauer right around 1999 and 2000. And I'd also written a novel that was set for that game, Dark Matter.
Strangest thing with a conspiracy theory I've ever had in a role-playing game was that first Forgotten Realms campaign that I was running for some of my family members, where for many of them, this was their first RPG ever. You know, it's family members and their significant others. My sister's boyfriend had seen something on, I don't know, Discovery or where he saw it, but just absolutely wanted the Bilderberg group worked into the background of his character.
So in Faerun, I think they're called the Red Wizards.
So I had to come up with, what I ended up doing was coming up with some kind of like a sort of merchants conspiracy in Symbia.
Okay.
And I renamed them the Harbor Group because it made more sense than having the Bilderbergs in Faerun.
Sounds good. I like it.
You have to play to the player character's desires. Ninja guy shows up. He wants to be a ninja. I've never had Bilderbergers guys show up.
I've had things. You got to build his strange burger. You know, not necessarily conspiracy theory based, but
being a gamer and a game designer, I did have to put a little bit of a game element in the book, in that there's an appendix at the back. There's tables, and you can randomly generate your own conspiracy theory.
Nice.
I might actually pick this book up. I'm reading a lot of nonfiction now. This sounds really
good. We should actually do a test here, sociological test, see how far we can get, randomly generate a conspiracy theory
and try to turn it into a real thing.
And then, like, we'll put up a website and see how far we can get with it.
The truth behind the flying Nazi boat conspiracy or something like that.
So you were WotC during the whole 3E thing. The OGL was obviously kind of a new idea within the realm of gaming. It seemed to mostly have borrowed its pages from the world of software in particular. But how did you feel about the OGL when you first heard about it? I mean, as someone who by this point already had, you know, quite a bit of history in the industry, when you first heard that idea pitched, what was your response?
When I first heard about it, I reacted like pretty much everyone in the company did, which was, that sounds like a terrible idea. but that was just our sort of knee-jerk reaction of, because Ryan Dancy, who was the guy kind of behind that idea, it sounded like he said, well, okay, so we produce D&D stuff. What if we just let everyone produce D&D stuff, right? That sounds like a terrible idea when you're the people who've been in charge of creating and shaping the game for so long.
Right, when you're at WotC and not Mel Havoc, for example.
Right, but you know, it took me literally about a day, maybe 2 days, to kind of figure out that was actually a really good idea and that it would be good for the game and it would allow the fan base itself to create products that filled holes that they saw needed filling. You know, there would be products that TSR, or rather Wizards, would never be able to produce, right, on super specific things or weird corner case situations or strange genres that would appeal to only 10 people, but it empowered other people to produce those things, which, you know, would add a whole new level of interest, add a whole new kind of life to the game. And I think that's exactly what it did.
Are you trying to tell me that TSR or Wizards would never have actually come out and produced the D20 Guide to Erotic Fantasy?
No.
There was some stuff in the Book of Vile Darkness, man.
There was. And actually, you know, in a way, it's the same person behind both books. Not on the creative end, but on the business end, actually.
Really?
Yes. Who is this individual?
Anthony Volterra was the business manager at Wizards of the Coast at the time. And, you know, when the Book of Vile Darkness was proposed by me, I just wanted to do a book with, you know, third edition stats for the demon lords and the
drugs and syphilis.
Well, no, not at first, right? I just wanted to do a book about demons and stuff and give DMs sort of new tools for creating new villains and whatnot.
Bigger and better bad guys, more evil bad guys.
Yeah.
And more erotic bad guys.
Well, no. The erotic wasn't in it yet.
Okay.
No,
all right.
No erotic. No, just demons.
It was Anthony who said, oh, let's really push the limits. Let's make a book that no one would ever have made for D&D before. And he just kind of kept pushing for new and weirder stuff. And I did, you know, put in a lot of creepy.
New and weirder stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But it still really wasn't, I don't think, the book that he wanted. So after he left the company and started doing his own D20 stuff, it was his company that produced the Book of Erotic Fantasy, which is clearly what he had really wanted. Book of Wild Darkness.
So I'm starting to understand that saying I want to push the boundaries or want new and different things is really just code speak within the industry for increased pornography.
More goblin boobies.
Hey, they're coming, buddy.
At least for some people, that must be true. Yeah.
Yes. So what do you run for your group? Do you have a gaming group?
I do, yeah.
I can't imagine you would tolerate this industry if you didn't game yourself.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people who write who either maybe they gamed when they were younger, but they don't game now, and it's just a joke.
Yeah, but a guy who's writing in randomly at age 20, you had to have some kind of a love for the hobby prior to that decision. It strikes me.
Yeah, when I hear somebody who works in the game industry as a creative, as a writer, or even as an editor, and they tell me, oh, I don't actually game anymore, I don't usually don't say it to their face, but inside I'm thinking, oh, good Lord, how could you be doing this and not actually be a gamer anymore?
Mad money, lots of bitches.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's why.
If you're doing this for the money, you're not thinking this through very well, I don't think.
You should switch to podcasting.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Where the cash is at.
All right. I'm making a note.
Johan got into it and got free Steak and Shake out of it.
Absolutely.
It only cost him $20 of gas.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, yeah, I've always maintained a game group. And I guess that kind of segues into where my career has been, because it was in the middle of 2011 when Wizards of the Coast came to me and said that they wanted to have me work on D&D again and kind of pitched this new idea that they had for kind of exploring new options with the rules. And so for the last year or so, I was working with Wizards of the Coast. During that time, the game that I was playing was playtesting the new game.
Well, sure, of course.
Fifth edition. So that's what it's been. And so now I'm not working for them anymore. So now I'm in a transitory period where I'm starting to work on a new role-playing game. Basically, some ideas that I put on hold back a year ago, because I went back to Wizards and that basically put everything that I had been working on hold, pulled out the old notebooks and the old computer files and started working on some stuff again. And so now my game group that I'm playing with, that's what we're just experimenting with at this point.
It's not so much a gaming group as it is free playtesters.
Well, you know, that's what every good game group is, right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
It is, really.
Free unwitting playtesters in many cases. Dan, right. Did you know that you were the prototype goblin?
No, I hadn't.
Good, because I didn't tell any of you. You've got to have a fresh set of eyes.
So is that your preferred stuff? Do you prefer doing mostly homebrew sorts of stuff as opposed to off-the-shelf games?
Yes. I'm always in game designer mode in a way, and so it's actually kind of difficult for me to sit down and just play somebody else's game rules as written using an adventure module that somebody else wrote. I love looking at that stuff and sort of mining it for ideas for my own home campaigns and whatnot, but it's difficult for me to not interject my own ideas and whatever into whatever it is that I'm running. So what ends up happening is, like, the entire time that I worked on Malhavik, for example, my game group, they were my playtesters, but it wasn't like, oh, I've got this great idea for a product and now we're going to playtest it. It was, well, I'm running my third edition game, you know, my D20 game, and I just created an adventure that was really fun, or I just created a bunch of new spells that worked out really well that filled a need that we had. Why don't I put that into a product, right? So it was kind of the reverse of most playtesting, in that the playtesting was kind of coming first, and then it was turning into a product.
So do you ever run into an instance where you're using material that you've already published, and it doesn't work right, and then your players look at you like, come on, you can't even blame the designer on this one.
It's a homebrew, guys. Come on. It's third edition. Yeah, well, I brewed it.
Well, absolutely, right? I mean, probably nobody has a bigger set of house rules for a third edition D&D than I do.
Yeah. And it's called
D&D.
So give me an example. What is an example of a Monty Cook fix to his own rule system?
They're not fixes. They're just house
rules. All right, a house rule, yeah.
Well, by the end... And actually, I did end up publishing almost all of this stuff in a book called The Book of Experimental Might, which is basically just my D&D house rules.
I'm glad this was not the third in your Vile Darkness Erotic Fantasy trilogy.
You know, I would do, I did things like...
P is for penetration, not piercing.
I'm trying to think of, you know, like I created a bunch of new house rules for fighters and those guys who basically started getting sort of the short end of the stick with the idea, you know, that wizards and other spellcasters were getting all this cool new stuff and the fighters just weren't getting the love. So I created a bunch of subsystems that basically allowed fighters to really specialize into all different kinds of martial arts and focus on weapons and stuff like that to give them something. And it, you know, it got a little complex, but I think that there's a corner of that market of the, you know, D&D 3.5 Pathfinder market that really digs complexity.
Mm-hmm. And oh, yes. Most of it, I would say.
Yeah. So it really appealed to them.
Yeah, I like that Pathfinder gave the fighters a little bit more love. I would say they're still quite far behind casters in raw game-affecting power, but now they have armor proficiency and more expansive set of feats. I like Pathfinder fighters a lot.
Well, you know, and a lot of the Pathfinder stuff actually comes from some of my house rules and stuff. I was the rules consultant on Pathfinder, and of course all of that stuff was open content. So Jason and I, you know, talked about a lot of that stuff.
Switching gears a little bit, we've interviewed a couple of guys from White Wolf, and one of the things that they say is that over at White Wolf, they game a lot. They game with each other, you know, in the office, they game out of the office, they have multiple gaming groups that are them working together. They game a lot of different systems that aren't White Wolf systems. On one hand, to see what the competition's doing, but really more because it's a lot of fun. All these other systems are a lot of fun to these guys.
Well, you know those guys at White Wolf are all a bunch of liars, right?
That's what I hear.
No.
I hear
no,
they,
and really, who wants to play White Wolf games all the time?
Yeah, I hear they Come just on. Run around in an eye mascara and go...
You could say that it's all a masquerade.
Oh. Well, my question is like, at TSR... Or WotC or whatever the hell they're calling themselves.
Hasbro,
you know, whatever. Is there that sort of gaming culture there of the, those guys gaming with each other and gaming stuff that isn't, yeah, WotC TSR stuff? Or is it people might game, but they just kind of do it in private with their private friends?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. When I started at TSR in 94, I had not actually been playing hardly any D&D for a very long time. And this would have been during the days of second edition D&D. And so when I got there, I sort of figured that I'd be playing a lot of D&D. And to my surprise, nobody there was playing D&D. In fact, I had to start a D&D group while I was there just so that we could do some playtesting of stuff that I was working on. And there was not a strong culture of gaming there. And what gaming was going on was other people's stuff, right? People were playing Call of Cthulhu and Shadowrun and things like that, which is fine. But what happened was when we started developing third edition, which would have been after the transition to Wizards, which we're talking about like 97, 98. It was one of those many, many indicators that we had that we were kind of on to something, because all of a sudden people in the office were playing regular D&D games. You know, it became a thing where, you know, everyone was playing sometimes two or three times a week. And by the time third edition came out, you couldn't even get into it. You know, everyone's games had waiting lists on them, right? They were just turned into sort of D&D Central. And I think it's still the case there at Wizards that everyone is...
I like how you phrase that. WotC kind of turned into D&D Central.
Well, you know, but coming from the experience that I had, that was actually strange and new.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's still that way, and there's also a healthy culture playing other people's games there, too.
So I have a question for you, Monty. We can't actually call Dungeons & Dragons Dungeons & Dragons when we're producing all this D20 OGL Pathfinder stuff. You invented the third edition, so I think this honor goes to you. What the hell are we supposed to call it? I'm tired of the world's most popular role-playing game. It's too wordy. Can I get, like, a code word or something?
Well, do you mean, like, officially or when you're sitting around the table?
No, officially. I am publishing a commercial supplement for D20 Pathfinder called Blood Moon Goblins. It's, like you said, a tiny little thing that could appeal to 10 people, but essentially the sales pitch is that you're player character goblins and you live in this tribe. But I have to reference Dungeons & Dragons without saying hey guys, this is what it's like in Dungeons and Dragons. So I just want to know, what can I call it from the man who invented it?
Well, so let me preface this by saying I am not a lawyer. This is
okay,
not
I am,
advice.
And you have my permission to say whatever the hell you want.
The thing is that, well, obviously with Pathfinder, they've got their nice open culture that they pretty much just let you say Pathfinder.
Yeah, right? I say PFRPG. They want you to say the Pathfinder role-playing game or PFRPG, so I've got that covered.
Otherwise, I guess you can't say Dungeons & Dragons, you can't say D&D, but there's a lot of things that you can say that mean the same thing to people, right? You can say third edition, right? You can say 3.5.
That's true.
And everyone knows what you're talking about. You know, that's one of the things about D20 is that, and one of the things that I actually loved about working on D20 was that you sort of knew that you were preaching to the converted. You know, you knew that the people that you were talking to would really know what the hell you're talking about. You didn't have to start every product out by saying, this is what a role-playing game is, right? I mean, these were people who had been doing it a long time. They were really invested in the hobby, and sometimes it's really fun to just talk to those people.
Just call it Layers and Lizards and call it a day.
I may do that. You know, I got the weirdest selection of monsters are trademarked, so keep your eyes open for the Blarian Brawler and the Blalatinous Bloob, because they're coming at you. When you see that sword just hovering in the middle of the room... Poke it with a stick first.
You know, we have a Twitter account, and I actually got on it today at the beginning of this interview, and I asked, you know, I said, you know, hey, we got Monty Cook on the mics. Do you have any questions for him? One of them on this sort of topic, John M. Wells, goes by Trigger Happy on our forums, actually, would like to know, what are your feelings on how Pathfinder developed?
That's a very long story. I think that...
Yes, content! I'm taking a nap, guys. Let him talk.
We've struck gold.
Does anyone have the PFRPG PHB? Because there's like 4 pages of Monty Cook's thoughts on how it developed at the very front.
Is it really?
Yes!
There actually is, yeah. Well, so... You know, it was the kind of thing where the actual development of the game, when Paizo realized that it was something that they wanted to do, and really in some ways kind of had to do if they were going to continue to support the 3rd edition 3.5 rule systems. With Wizards of the Coast putting out 4th edition at the time, Paizo knew that they had, in order to support the game that they wanted to support, they basically had to publish the rules, right? Because Wizards wasn't going to be putting out 3rd edition players' handbooks anymore. Right. And so I think very canny of them, they decided to not just reprint the D20 SRD, but instead take it and make some improvements on it. And so Jason Bowman, the designer, sat down and started working on a lot of stuff. And because Paizo contacted me and hired me to be my title was rules consultant. Basically what that meant was Jason would occasionally call me up and say, I'm looking at this table in the Dungeon Master's Guide. Where the heck do these numbers come from? And so I would, you know, explain to him and tell him the story or whatever of
we
why
made
we did
them up.
You know, why we did things the way we did. And he sort of asked me about some of the tricky issues and whatnot. But, you know, the game was definitely his creation. I mean, other than the fact that it's based on 3.5. So that was sort of how the game developed. And then from there, it's kind of fascinating to watch how well Paizo has supported the game with great adventures and content. It's kind of one of those quote-unquote truisms that for a long time everyone believed that adventures don't sell and you have to sell people books of rules, right? You have to keep churning out books of prestige classes and feats and whatever. And Paizo's done a great job of building basically a business model around doing great adventures and great source material and doing very, very well. I mean, as we have all seen over the last couple of years with Pathfinder being this great selling product. You know, we live in interesting times when basically the number one selling role-playing game in the world is Dungeons & Dragons, and the number two best-selling role-playing game in the world is Dungeons & Dragons. Just one of them is called Pathfinder.
So with the products you're working on now, are you still trying to focus on D20, or are you starting from scratch with new rule systems, or where are you headed with Malhavik, if you don't mind telling us?
Well, Malhavik will pretty much always be a D20 company. So I will always use Malhavik you know, if that's the rule system that I want to work on, you know, for example, if I was going to put out, you know, a Pathfinder adventure or something, or it would be under Malhavik.
So your answer, though, seemed to leave a lot of wiggle room of implying that there's another company that you're doing on the side of Malhavik that's making something other than D20.
Right. Yeah, that's actually what I was getting at. what I'm working on now, and it really it's just in the very early sort of idea stages, but what I'm working on now is not at all D20. It's not at all Dungeons and Dragons-like. And if that actually it turns into a product one day, I will probably, just so that people won't get something that they weren't expecting, I probably will have to create something new, some new banner under which to sell it. And I don't even know what that would be at this point.
Palladium.
Well, I hate to tell you this, Monty, but I have a feeling that unless you change your name, the Malhavik logo doesn't hold nearly as much water as Monty Cook on the cover does.
I'm going to have to agree with them. If you walked up to me and said Monty Cook, there's some things that would immediately come to mind. You walked up to me and said Malhavik, I'd probably have to take out my phone and start Googling.
Yeah, I've been told many times that it was a mistake to not just call Malhavik Press, you know, Monty Cook Games or whatever. I have ego issues with that, right? It just sounds so...
Martyr Wise.
Yeah, I
know. Tyler Perry's Why Did I Roll a Fighter?
Yeah, it's really, it's kind of obnoxious.
You know, people give me a lot of crap for things like I did Monty Cook's World of Darkness and some other things that had my name on it. But, you know, the real truth is that I did all of those sort of under duress. Someone had to kind of put a gun up to my head, actually, to get me to do that. But I understand the point that you're making, right? I understand that thanks in part to doing this for 24 years and thanks in part for my name being on the D&D Player's Handbook, my name probably does mean more to people than something like Malhavik Press. So I don't know. Maybe I will have to do something like that.
Like change your name?
Malhavix Tolis.
Cool. I like that.
So, my name is Josen. You will resurrect my brand.
So genre-wise, this new stuff you're working on, obviously you're kind of holding back, so I presuppose you don't want to tell a whole lot about it. Can you at least give us a genre or something? Just kind of a little bit of a sense of what you've got.
I'm looking at a rules system that is so simple and straightforward that it could be easily detached and just kind of be this really simple short little product that would be a RPG rule system for pretty much anything you wanted to use it for.
Does it use a Jenga tower?
Does not. No, okay, I thought it would go with, you know, the little boot and the race car and stuff that you have in a Monopoly set.
Yes.
But I would go with that instead.
Excellent. I get to be the cannon.
Thimble. Always the cannon.
Or the battleship.
I'm such a setting genre guy, though, that what I will probably do is I will probably release, if this was to become a product, I would probably want to release it as a game with a setting and a genre, and then later on release the rules themselves as a separate product. So right now, the thing that I'm kind of really caught up in and interested in is science fantasy, the kind of thing where science fiction and fantasy are so closely interwoven that you can't really even tell where one begins and the other ends. So that's certainly the setting that I'm using right now for my playtests and stuff.
By science fantasy, do you mean where it blurs the line between science fiction and fantasy, or it goes kind of towards the most recent Marvel rendition of Thor where magic might as well be a science? So,
yes.
Okay.
Both of those things.
Now actually, write that up.
It's like a spelljammer that makes sense.
I hope it's not at all like spelljammer.
I also hope it's
you
not
and me
all
both,
like
Monty. You and me both.
I love spelljammer.
Of course you.
You also
do.
Like the Confederates versus Tyrannosaurus in space or whatever the hell.
And I can't still have yet to find anyone who will play that stupid game with me.
Bring it to a convention. We will have you run a game of it.
So I was flipping through your Wikipedia entry. They've actually deleted ours for our podcast. They say we weren't noteworthy.
So we just added ours to the end of yours.
I hope you don't mind.
We gave 6 years of lead up to tonight.
There was a section in there that had a lot of citation needed on it, so I don't know how true this is or not, but it was saying something about you and drive-through RPG and the DRM on your PDFs, and it said that you succumbed to pressure to add DRM or something like that.
Really?
What the hell are they talking about?
You know, it's been a really long time since I've looked at my own Wikipedia entry.
Now, just to give you a sense of our
by
view.
The way, you also have 3 wives and 10 children.
Oh, well, that's
according to Wikipedia.
But on the good side, you're only 23. So,
how weird is it anyway for someone to look at their own Wikipedia entry? You know, why would you need to ever do that?
I don't know. Stare at it all day long.
But I think what they're talking about, to actually answer your question, was in 2001 when I started Mel Havoc Press, and I had just no freaking idea what I was doing. I didn't want to do the whole print a product and put it in a warehouse, which of course would have been my garage at the time and everything. I didn't want to deal with all that. So I released the books only electronically, which I wasn't like trying to be way ahead of the times or innovative or whatever. I was just doing it because that was the only way I could do it. But at the time, it turned out that I was kind of on to something. And so now, you know, we see ebooks and everything becoming super popular. But right around, I don't even remember the date. I was selling ebooks long before there was a drive-through RPG or even an RPG Now or any of those things. But basically, when drive-through started up, they really wanted me to be a part of what they were selling. And
you personally?
Yes.
That's kind of creepy.
So they only rented them out.
Did that Book of Erotic Fiction guys come up with this idea?
Drive-thru is actually based out of Thailand.
And it was all electronic. It wasn't the actual physical me. So it's all.
Okay.
Right. No, that's better.
5 minutes of webcam time.
Yeah. Monty Cam. That should be the name of your new company.
Yeah. I'll make
the full Monty Cam.
Oh. He's never heard that joke before.
Yeah. Oh, it only took an hour to get there.
We're professionals.
Yeah, that's right.
Monty Cook's Pants Unleashed. Okay,
right. Drive-through RPG, right.
Right, so they wanted Mel Havoc products to be sold there, and they kind of convinced me that they were the next big thing, and they used DRM. And so for like 15 minutes... all of our products had DRM on them, and everyone said, this is a terrible idea. And I said, my God, you're right. And so then they went away. So I guess that's me succumbing to pressure.
Yeah. Your Wikipedia entry as of 5 minutes ago did in fact say succumb. And for once, I did not actually vandalize that into the intro.
We have, however, though, we have before used Wikipedia to win debates. And if it doesn't agree with you, you just change what it says.
But
our crowning achievement, Monty, how much are you into history?
No. My crowning achievement was I was in a debate with you, Dan, on whether or not
this is
a tangerine.
This was not your crowning achievement.
No, this was my crowning achievement.
No, it was not.
Yes, it was whether or not a tangerine or mandarin orange was an orange.
No, it's
No.
Little one's called.
It's a clementine.
Clementine.
Yeah, they were all the same.
Exactly what a clementine
is. I held one position, you held another. I vandalized the Wikipedia entry on that, linked it back to you to prove my point. You clicked it, read it. I'm sorry, Chad, you're absolutely right.
That is not your crowning achievement. Your crowning achievement, this was a good one. Monty, how much are you into history? Really obscure, weird sort of history.
I'm into history, but I don't know if I'm into the obscure stuff.
There is a real guy from history whose name has not come up on the show for a while. Johan's already shaking his head.
Yes, I am.
In the 1800s, there was a sideshow guy in the Old West whose most popular act, which is the name he came to be known by, was something called Oofty Goofty. All right. And he did all these weird sideshow acts where, like, he'd tar and feather himself and pretend to be some kind of monster and then had trouble getting out of that and seriously injured himself. And finally, his career ended when he decided to go from the sideshow to the freak show, and he would let people give him money in return to hit him. And apparently one guy like seriously damaged his spine with a baseball bat or some kind of a stick.
Vertebrae.
Yeah. And really messed him up, which was the end of his career. But Chad merged the entries for Dart Tower and Oofty Goofty and had this narrative about Oofty Goofty climbing the Dart Tower.
Yes, I replaced all the references to Roland and all of his descriptions in the Dart Tower Wikipedia thing with Oofty Goofty and his life. And it stayed that way for days. No one caught it.
So if you want our view of Wikipedia and how seriously we take what it says about you, there you go.
I am the reason people don't trust Wikipedia.
We may merge you with Clementines before the night is over.
Oh my God, what a great idea.
Monty Cook invented Clementines.
On it.
What's the best class in third edition?
Oh, boy.
Oh, come on. Everyone knows the answer to that.
Actually, something I wanted to...
You said the bard? Hold on. We got 5 minutes here.
Go on. I agree with you, but go on.
What?
I know.
Really? You agree?
Yes, I do.
Ah, are you, you're a guy who likes to min rather than max? Is that what you're saying?
God, I wish Wayne was here. Monty Cook just said you suck, Wayne. Stop playing bards.
I had a DM who was going to start up a new campaign using the third edition rules. And I once convinced everyone else in the group, because, you know, he was saying this is going to be a really difficult campaign, combat heavy, you know, it's going to be really intense. I convinced everyone else in the group to make a bard and play a bard. But we actually took it even farther than that. And we not only all played bards, but we all played wildly incompetent bards. So everyone was like a bard or whatever. And they didn't have good charismas. They weren't even good at being bards. And so we showed up at his ultra serious, high combat, really intense game with all these just wildly incompetent characters, and it was funny for a session.
I think that'd be funny for about 8 or 10 sessions until the GM figured out that you were just trolling him.
He figured it out after about 8 or 10 minutes.
Yeah. You guys sold it too hard. I would have been like, I want to be this tragic hero.
Yeah, so you got to find some middle ground where it's not quite so obvious and see how long you can get away with it. But I always liked the Bard class for two reasons. One, I always liked the fact that they were kind of a flex class because, I don't know, within the 3E rule set, I am not an expert min-maxer, and I'll probably be like, yeah, you can play Bard. So, but, you know, one of the things I always was really good at within that rule system was using the utility to my advantage. Forget the stats. There's so much you can do with some of those utility spells to bend
Wizard.
The game. The other thing was Bardic Knowledge.
Cleric.
If Bardic Knowledge is not a devastating ability, either the GM's being a dick to you or you don't know how to use it.
Oh, this beholder's left eye has its laser beam.
Well, you know,
that worked well.
In all seriousness, you do bring up a good point.
Red dragons, immune to fire.
They are sort of the best jack of all trades class, and so they're really good at that point. The problem is that ultimately the D20 system doesn't reward jacks of all trades
exactly.
Very well. Yeah, it really rewards you to super specialize and become really, really good, not just with weapons, not just with longswords, not just with a type of longsword, but like one specific longsword, you know. That's really the best way to max your character
and use
out.
It in one specific way.
Exactly. You know, yeah,
I specialize in the style of tripping somebody and then hitting them when they're down.
Right, but you take away that guy's longsword and he's nothing, right? He's a turtle laying on his back.
I can run a great color spray omancer until we start hitting enemies that have 6 hit dice.
John, he just sent down a Voight comp reference and nothing there at all.
No, I picked it up.
Well, I know you picked it up, but I just expect.
I want to talk about color spray.
All right. Go ahead, color spray.
That's it. That was the whole point.
Okay.
Color spray.
All right, Monty, you're a first level wizard. You can have 2 spells. What do you take?
I'm first level.
Yes.
So I'm. Okay, so while I'm facing first level.
You have like 16 int. You get +1 level 1 spell.
I'm probably going to go with mage armor and either color spray or sleep.
Oh, a mage armor. A defensive guy. I'm surprised. I thought it would have been color spray times 2, because that's what I would have picked.
That's totally what I would have picked.
We're like half there.
If you let somebody get close enough to hit you, you lost already.
But if you're dealing with that GM who wants to send like 50 kobolds at you, sleep is actually better. I got to give you that.
And, you know, I'm afraid that the fighter's not going to protect me, so I'm going to go with mage armor.
No, he's probably not. Fighters are always assholes. I could never roll a fighter since you gave D12 hit points to Barbarian. I was like 15 when 3rd came out. And I thought D12 hit points was just outrageous and unstoppable.
Yeah. Do you know when we initially designed third edition, at one point we had accidentally written the D12 out of the game? There was absolutely no use for that die at all. So, at the last
so you minute, invented the barbarian in just to put the D12 in?
And the great axe, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought like large long swords and great axes and stuff.
Only the great axe. Man.
Only the great axe?
You know,
axe.
Now you need to back up and fix where they lost the D30 from the system.
And why would we do that?
I have like one of the six that still exist on Earth and no use for it.
The lodestone of role-playing games.
You know, you could come out with a D20 product, but call it a D20, but like with a circle and a line through the D20 and call it D30.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
That would appeal to tens of people.
By the way, speaking
that's
of,
going on the cover. This will appeal to tens of people. Monty Cook. Dan Repetcher's name in 4-point font underneath it.
By the way, speaking of appeal, I don't know if it'll still be there by the time this show drops, but we did just change your Wikipedia entry. Chad did specifically to credit you with having invented Clementines.
I'll definitely go take a look at that when I'm
and my
done.
IP will now probably be banned from Wikipedia.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're on your phone. Okay.
So if the formatting's all screwed up, that's why.
So as one last question of D&D wankery for you, Monty, could you tell me where in the design process somebody decided to put back in barbarians and monks, which, if I remember right, didn't exist at all in second edition?
No, nor sorcerers.
Right. Well, sorcerers never existed, but right, barbarians and monks were first edition and then got dropped.
Right. Well, sorcerers came along because we decided we definitely wanted there to be something brand new for that edition. But yeah. Barbarians and half-orcs and all of those first edition things, we decided pretty early on that we didn't want third edition to not have something that either first or second edition had. If you were still playing first edition and were playing a half-orc barbarian, we wanted you to be able to keep playing that character in third edition.
What about so my Cavalier? We kept it.
No. You never played it.
But I want to bend bars and lift gates.
Well, Cavaliers do exist in third edition, but they came along as a prestige class a little bit later.
Right.
And yeah. I think so there's a core class in Pathfinder for Cavaliers.
That was a rough
in the
prestige
PhD
class,
two?
Too.
Something
there
like
is. Yeah, so, in Pathfinder, there is.
Aside from these two knuckleheads, D&D wank, there is actually another halfway decent question on Twitter. Marshall Miller asked you to settle a bet for him.
Uh-oh.
He says, what game is most different from D&D? Basically, what is the antithesis of D&D in your opinion? And this is very important because this is settling a bet for the man.
Is this multiple choice?
It's not multiple. It's just anything?
And what to you? To Monty Cook, what is the antithesis of D&D?
I would say football.
I would have gone with Jenga.
It is a game.
I think he's asking
lateral
for. All right, let's hear us down. I think he's asking for a role playing game.
He did not specify.
No, he did not. I said I think. And
okay. So you're the arbiter of.
BS. That was the answer, man.
Yeah. Game.
This
pay up.
This is a capricious kangaroo court. I want let's get an RPG name.
Okay.
There's a football RPG out there somewhere, I guarantee.
There's a wrestling one.
There's Blood Bowl, kind of RPG ish. Not really, but kind of.
You know, maybe I'd go with something like Fiasco. Yeah.
I can see that.
You know, but I love Fiasco, so it's weird to think of that as the anti-D&D. But, you know, that's pretty far, right?
Well, it doesn't mean that it's bad.
Anything without a GM, it's pretty far from D&D.
Montesquieu 1244. I played that at Fear the Con. That's pretty far from D&D. Totally GM-less. You're given cards that have a couple of little character, not even notes, questions about it in a setting, and then you work through acts and you tell this story.
Don't you all die in the end? Like, no matter what happens?
Not everybody dies in Monstergore. Most people burn for their faith, then several are killed in the battle, and I think one person gets to get let go and one person escapes if you play it right. We didn't get that far.
What a cheery game.
It is. It's...
That doesn't sound like you killed something and took everything that it owns and got experience point for it.
No.
It's like Titanic, the role-playing game, and you're only allowed to play Irishmen.
Yeah. No, it is. Monstergore is you play, according to the medieval Catholic Church, heathens. And you have a fortress in the Pyrenees. It's indestructible. It cannot be. No army can crush it.
Right.
And then the Roman Catholics take an army and basically crush it. Pull all of the heathens out and start burning them. And you play the heathens that get burned.
I want to play Spelljammer Titanic now. I'm running that at Fear the Con 6. Everyone sign up right now.
How does it sink? It's in space.
It strikes
it's
a space asteroid iceberg.
But it's an infinite void. It just keeps sinking and sinking.
Okay. Spelljammer Titanic by Monty Cook. Oh. It has to run into a giant space hammer. But
by Monty
now,
Cook?
Okay.
That sounds awesome. All right. I'm going to buy that one.
The same guy that made Clementines?
Yes.
John, the character should be like McGiff. Oh, GIF.
No, I'm going to make like Jack the hippopotamus and Rose the space hamster. I don't even know what the races are in Spelljammer. I hate it so much. But I know there's hippos.
That was the GIFs.
Those are the GIFs?
That's the GIFs.
Okay,
that's,
I didn't know that.
I was trying to make Irish GIFs.
Yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to the GIF and the Githzaki and the Githzerakai. They all run together to me, like the Irish.
I'd like to apologize to all blind people.
No, I'm half Irish.
All right, so, Monty, in case people are looking for you and want something more accurate than what we've done to your Wikipedia page, where do they find you? I know you've got blogs and stuff out there, but where do people look you up? And obviously, we'll link all this in the show notes so people can track you down if they want to see what you're up to.
It's pretty tough to remember web address.
Or if they want to vandalize your Wikipedia page.
Yes.
Right. Or if they just want a discount on Clementines.
Yeah.
So, MontyCook.com.
If I paid you by the word and wrote an RPG, would you write me a completely non sequitur 4-page intro on your thoughts on the development of the Clementine?
You'd have to pay me pretty well because I'd have to do some research because I don't have a clue.
No,
research, Monty. No, yeah, you're missing the point.
If you have to research, you have failed.
I get to make it up?
That's correct.
It's not. Don't think of it as making it up. Think of it as declaring the truth.
And I just want to, it will totally leave people befuddled and angry and trying to return the product because they'll pick it up and it'll be like this and that role-playing a foreword by Monty Cook.
It's like, yes!
The history of Clementine oranges.
No. See, I think people will be so like, well, it's Monty Cook. It's great, right? Right? And be like, yeah, Monty Cook, it's great. They'll just convince each other it's wonderful.
That sounds like a great
like they'll do with this episode.
But the next step in my career.
All right, so where do people...
Either that or a great fiasco scenario.
So where do people look you off?
MontyCook.com. It's actually, as we speak, sort of in the process of being completely redesigned. So it'll look new and cool and like something that was designed in the last 10 years pretty soon. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Google+, and you can't get me to shut up there. So
okay. Nice. Cool. Very good. Well, Monty, I want to thank you very much for taking some time out of your evening to talk with us. It was a lot of fun having you on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had a great time. Thanks for inviting me.
And as for all of you folks at home, you know, check the show notes for some links to about Havoc and Monty Cook and all these various things we've talked about.
And just remember, each time you eat a tangerine, a mandarin orange, or clementine, Monty Cook gets a nickel.
It's true. That's how he makes money in the RPG industry.
If
you didn't know, it's in horticulture.
It is.
So thank you all for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.